The word credit has its roots in the Latin for the verb to believe, and it's the currency of the global financial system as much as the dollar, the pound, the euro, or the renminbi. But since the fall of 2008, credit, along with the global markets, has taken a tumble, and recovering from our current crisis might mean changing the way we think about credit, money, and the global economy. Philip Coggan, the Buttonwood columnist for The Economist, was on our show this past February to discuss his book on credit called Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. It was a fascinating conversation, and we're airing it for you again today. I began by asking Philip Coggan, is a knowledge of history as important to understanding our current financial crisis as a knowledge of economics?
I think it is. I think economists talk in theories and equations and things, and they miss the human angle sometimes, that we have throughout history battled between creditors and debtors, and we have battled over the nature of money. And this latest crisis is just one of a whole series of crises that have recurred over that long period.
So did the same sorts of things always trigger a crisis? Is it always when debtors can no longer repay their creditors?
Yes. If you think back to the 1930s, that was a time up to then money was based on gold. And in the 1930s, countries were just overwhelmed by the need to repay their debts. And they were imposing, rather like Greece and Italy today, austerity measures on the populations. And the population eventually rebelled. Democratic politicians cannot push through this kind of pain on their voters year after year. And the whole system was abandoned.
But we're also caught in another kind of bind. It's impossible to create growth without credit. And yet at the same time, there's always a natural tension between debtors and their creditors.
There is. I think it is possible to create growth without credit.
But, is it?
Yes, it is possible.
Yeah, but I have to have a lot of money of my own to do that.
No, you can get growth just by the fact that there being more people in the world. We did have growth in a world where credit was restricted. But yes, there at the times of crisis, there is this underlying tension between debtors who want a lot more money to be created. So we have this thing called quantitative easing, which is the creation of more money, and creditors who want the supply of money to be restricted. So they're paid back in proper money, not in funny money. And so the 1930s was an example of that. 1970s, we abandoned the system of fixed exchange rates that had lasted up to that time, and then suddenly exchange rates started moving against each other, which they have for the last 40 years. And now we have another crisis again, which is in Europe is all about, again, fixing an exchange rate. All the countries have tied themselves to Germany, essentially, and the fixed euro. And then this huge crisis in the rest of the world where particularly America has run up huge debts to China. And we are in the process of sorting out how that relationship between America and China will work from now on.
But haven't we done a lot better than most of the countries in Europe in dealing with this crisis?
We have. We have the flexibility in America and Britain, of course, which is not part of the euro, that we can depreciate our currencies, let them fall. So essentially, rather than in Greece, where you cannot easily get out of the crisis by, as they used to, devaluing their currencies and paying back people slightly worse, they have to actually not pay back the money, default. In America and Britain, we can slowly let the dollar and the pound fall. We can slowly have inflation. But the risk is that you overdo it. And the debt is so large that you need an awful lot of inflation to get rid of it.
Do these kinds of crises often give rise to populist responses? I'm thinking about this country, the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street, although they are very different. They both arose out of this debt crisis. Now we're seeing the rise in support of I don't know what we call it, but the very right-wing, almost fascist party in France, and the same thing's happening in Italy.
They do. And one key character in my book is William Jennings Bryan, who is this almost like the Barack Obama of the late 19th century. He was this wonderful orator, Midwest senator, and he campaigned for the kind of people who are now Tea Party voters. They were farmers out in the heartland of America. And they, back then, wanted more money to be created. William Jennings Bryan said, you shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold. He wanted quantitative easing. He wanted silver to be added to the currency. And he was opposed by the kind of people on Wall Street who believed in sound money. Now, go forward 100 years, and it's flipped around. The Tea Party is in the sound money camp, and Wall Street wants quantitative easing. So it's really strange. But you're right. In the 1930s, again, in Europe, we saw the rise of fascism. When you get to these kind of economic crises and you're dividing up a smaller pie, then you get tension between rich and poor, between young and old, and the temptation to blame foreigners or minorities is very strong.
And where would Ron Paul fit in all of this? He wants to return us to the gold standard.
Well, the easy temptation is to find some sort of simple solution to it, to fix the value of money. And I understand the appeal of a return to the gold standard, because clearly we've gone quite crazy in the amount of money and debt we've been created. But the reason we gave up on the gold standard, why no country is still on anything like a gold standard, is that at those moments of crisis, the system breaks down. And if you think about it, Greece now is on a kind of gold standard. It's not linked to gold, but it has linked to the German currency. And Greece just can't cope with it. And that's why people stopped fixing the amount of money and stopped fixing the exchange rate.
Well, the value of gold has skyrocketed since we left the gold standard, although it has gone up and down over the years. And now, I guess because of unease, it's higher than it's ever been.
Yeah, you can view gold, which is very difficult to value, as a kind of inverse relationship to the faith in paper money. Our money's basically based on faith. We have to believe that the government can stand behind it. And when governments get into financial trouble, we start to doubt it. And that's why we favor gold, which is limited in supply.
Well, my economics teacher many years ago said that paper money represents the total wealth of a country, not just what we have stored away in Fort Knox.
Well, that indeed, your economics teacher was echoing another guy who features in the book called John Law, who was the advisor to the Regent of France in the early 18th century. And he said the wealth of France is in our farms and our factories and not in the gold and silver in our vault. So we had this brilliant, he was the kind of first Paul Krugman or first Keynes. He said, create lots more money, then there'll be more trade, and then you will be able to pay off your debts. And that's basically that argument is still being played out today. Some people say, like Mr. Krugman, if you create more money, then the economy will grow its way out of the debt. Other people say, no, no, that's nonsense. Adding debt won't solve a debt crisis.
But printing paper money makes it easier to manipulate the value of currency.
It does, and that's why people have always been suspicious of it. I was reflecting on the way here that in the Second World War, Germany dropped fake pound notes on Britain as a way of trying to sabotage the British economy. Now we have the Bank of England, which is deliberately creating more money to try and rescue the British economy. So economic thinking does flip around quite frequently. And that's why it's always astonishing. Economists are so certain they're right all the time, and yet they change their mind every few years.
Well, you said that currencies made of gold or silver have a finite supply by their very nature. There's still plenty of gold out there, isn't there?
I think all the gold that's ever been mined would fill a cube the size of a tennis court. There's a limited supply of gold. That's why people value it so highly. So when you have if you had a system based on gold, you wouldn't actually be exchanging gold all the time. You'd have to say each dollar is worth a certain amount of gold. And of course, once you do that, you could say, let's say a dollar was worth a thousandth of an ounce of gold. Next week, you could say it was worth a 2,000th of an ounce of gold, and you could have the same issues arising all over again.
Well, how did the Romans value their currency?
They used gold and silver coins, and they used to all circulate round together. So you'd use coins from Athens and Rome and Byzantium, and all would be mixing together, and it would be the amount of gold and silver in that currency. But it was an old tactic of monarchs to take all your currency existence, melt it down, add some copper, and then send it all out again. So Henry VIII was known as Old Copper Nose, because if you kept your coins for long enough, the silver on top would rub off, and you'd see his copper nose underneath.
The United States abandoned the gold standard fairly recently, 1971, during the Nixon administration.
That's right.
And did the Republicans know that a Republican did that?
I don't think they do. Some people still do blame that for part of our trouble. And they're right in the sense that this was a huge experiment in history, that essentially up until then, gold and silver had some sort of basis for all our money. Since then, all our money is based on faith.
We did it first, and then other countries followed suit? Or were we following other countries?
What had happened was that after the Second World War, all currencies were linked to the dollar, and the dollar was linked to gold. So previously, you could exchange within Britain or Germany your own currency for gold. The only way you could do it under Bretton Woods was to exchange your dollars for gold. But the key system there was you abandoned fixing the exchange rate. That was the big change in the 70s.
Didn't the financial sector around the world start to grow rapidly around the same time? Was that just a coincidence?
No, I don't think it was a coincidence. Once you Under the old system, you were restricted in the amount of money you could take overseas or invest overseas. All that changed under Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. Suddenly, money started flowing around the world. Trading vastly expanded. I was being told the other day that the average holding period for a US stock is now 22 seconds. So trading on exchanges took off. So all that needed much bigger financial institutions to handle it. And that's why they grew so big relative to the economy. And, of course, that's why it was so dangerous when they went bust in 2008.
Was that the beginning of the widening divide between Wall Street and Main Street?
Yeah. Up until 1980, financial professionals didn't earn that much more than other similarly qualified people. But from that point on, their payments exploded. And that's because, of course, they were essentially gearing their pay to asset markets. And from 1980, we had this huge boom in equities, then this huge boom in house prices, and finance rode on the back of that.
My guest is Philip Coggan, who's the Buttonwood columnist of The Economist. Previously, he worked for the Financial Times. He's written a book called Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. It's published by Public Affairs. Does the global financial system always hinge on the biggest creditor?
Yes. If you look back over history, the gold standard, which has existed up until 1914 and its best function, was essentially devised by Britain. Sir Isaac Newton, indeed, was the first person who sort of triggered it. And he made a mistake. He undervalued silver and relative to gold, and all the silver coins got hidden away and gold coins got circulated. Other countries followed Britain's lead, and Britain was the dominant economy in the 19th century. Then in the 20th century, America took over, and we had systems, Bretton Woods, which I mentioned, which were American devised.
So in the 21st century, will it be the Middle East and China? Because they now are the major suppliers for things that we all need.
Yes, I think that's what's going to happen. Because when we have these crises and debtors fail to repay their money, which is what's happening, then eventually the creditors and debtors have to reach a new deal. And I see some sort of deal whereby China agrees to let its currency appreciate at a certain rate, America agrees to limit its deficit, and Europe has to go along.
Now, until more modern times, many countries would make it difficult to take gold out of their countries. What was the thinking during the Reagan-Thatcher years?
The thinking was that markets were all-knowing and all-wise. So if you just let markets sort it out, then exchange rates would move to a normal sort of natural level. Markets would find their own level. You couldn't have bubbles. Unfortunately, the result of that was a very, very big bubble. Central banks basically always intervened to save the markets when they were crumbling and never capped the bubbles. And that's why we ended up with this rather huge mess.
Was the explosion on Wall Street because they were able to leverage money much more effectively?
Yes. I mean, banks basically had much bigger balance sheets than they did. In the 19th century, banks would have capital ratios of some 25%. Now it's of 3 or 4. And as a result of that, you know, if they made the correct bet on asset markets, their staff made out like bandits. But, of course, we were landed with the bill when their bets went wrong.
Well, in this country, until fairly recently, banks could only be in one state. They were limited. We had a lot more small banks. And then at a certain point, we allowed banks to consolidate, become national. Has that created a real problem along these lines?
I think it's more the international nature of them. I mean, if you think back to Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, they used to be partnerships where it was just the people's capital of the individuals being put at risk. Then, because they had to deal with these huge worldwide flows, they just had to get much bigger. They had to float on the stock market. And they became these huge institutions that were too big to fail.
And we heard recently about deals that were struck with banks like Barclays Bank of England to hide some of the money, or I'm not exactly sure what happened there. It sounded all very arcane. But perhaps it's a scandal. Perhaps it's just the way business is conducted today.
Yeah, when you set up sort of targets, anything government set up targets, there's an incentive to try and manage the target, not deal with the problem. And that happened with Greece, of course, hiding some of its debt. And the danger is that without sufficient regulation, or indeed with the people who are regulating having an interest in the outcome, then you fail to control the amount of debt that's created.
Well, in the case of the Eurozone, there are many different needs when it comes to monetary policy. The Greeks need something very different than the Germans. Does that mean that there are even fewer options for the Eurozone than there are for individual countries?
Definitely. You need to get an agreement. Essentially, somebody's voters have to be disappointed. So German voters do not see why they should bail out Greece, where the citizens retire earlier and work less. And Greek voters do not see why they should have years of austerity just to pay the Germans off.
Well, if we were in the old system, the Greeks would have more options if they could default, for example. They can't now.
They are defaulting. They are in the process of writing off 70% of the value of their private sector debts. But in the old system, they would just devalue their currency. That would be kind of devaluation, default by stealth.
But right now, the French and the Germans are concerned about that going too far because of fears of contagion within the Eurozone.
Yes. I mean, either of two things happens. Either if you let the Greeks off, then why in Ireland or Portugal should you suffer years of pain and austerity if the Greeks don't have to pay back the debt? Or if you let the Greeks leave the euro, if you're an Irish or a Portuguese bank depositor and you see that suddenly in Greece people have lost 30-40% of their money, because, of course, in Greece, you would no longer have the euros in your bank account. You'd have drachma, which would be worth a lot less. You'd think, oh, I'll take my money out of my bank or the Portuguese banks and move it to Germany. So you'd get a very quick crisis if that happened.
Of course, we had a crisis earlier when Iceland's banks suddenly couldn't pay off their debts. And that was a big problem in Britain. I don't know what the end result of that has been. Did British people who sent money over to Iceland just take a big loss?
The government stepped in and guaranteed the deposits, demanded that Iceland back up that guarantee with money.
And then Iceland had a plebiscite and they voted against it.
Exactly. So they've reached a deal where Britain is not getting all the money back it wanted, or at least the Icelanders are paying it back very slowly at a much reduced rate. So in the end, governments stand behind their domestic banking system. And that's a key lesson of this crisis, really. We're all dependent on our faith in governments. And when faith in governments breaks down, as it has in Greece, then you have a huge problem.
Let's come back to something you talked about, quantitative easing. The Federal Reserve has turned to it recently. They've done it twice. So how does that ease pressures on the market?
Well, the idea is that when interest rates are at zero, as they currently are, you can't cut interest rates anymore. You can't have negative interest rates. So the only way of trying to encourage borrowing and lending in the economy is to pump more money in. So you buy assets off the banking sector and the banks have money which they can lend. What's happening at the moment, unfortunately, is there's still not that much lending to small businesses, which is where we want it. A lot of the money is sitting in banks. But it is keeping borrowing rates very low. So if companies and individuals wanted to borrow, the rate at which they can borrow is lower than it might otherwise be.
And Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke has said that they're unlikely to raise the benchmark interest rate until 2014, which is suggesting that if it's not happening today, you still have a chance to do it tomorrow?
Yes. I mean, it's astonishing in history. The Bank of England, which has existed for 320 years, never had interest rates below 2% until quite recently. And now it's got rates at 0.5%. Same with the Fed. It just shows how worried central banks are that they're having to commit to keep interest rates this low for this long. And it shows, and I think the problem with it all is it creates a system where the markets are dependent entirely on the central bank. The economy is dependent entirely on central banks propping up banks. And we've become a kind of like a junkie that we can't get off our debt habit, and we have to keep getting hit after hit from the central bank to keep us going.
But isn't at least some of the weakness in certain economies due to demographic issues like an aging workforce? How can a government or a central bank do anything about that?
I don't think they
can. Japan is facing that problem.
Exactly.
Seriously.
The best way to get out of a debt crisis is to grow your economy. And you grow your economy by having more workers or making them more productive. In many European countries and Japan, there'll be fewer workers. So we have to make workers more productive, which is why in Greece and Italy, there are reforms being pushed through, which will help. But it will take years for those reforms to actually bear fruit in terms of a higher growth rate.
Is it significant that many banks today make much of their money with fees, not from the profits from their investment portfolios?
I think the banks have to make money every which way. When interest rates are very low, it's harder for the banks to make money from lending and borrowing. So they have to find different ways of making money off us. And it's up to the individual consumer to be as smart as they can and try and head off and move to other banks which are not charging to avoid that problem.
Do you think that the current crisis could end up reshaping our attitudes toward money?
I think they do. My father, who was brought up in the 1930s, he would not have a credit card. He did not like the idea of being in debt. But for someone like me, in my generation, being a baby boomer, we were used to borrowing lots, having credit cards, having high mortgages. I think kids emerging from college today, you know, they'll have student loans. They won't be able to buy a house instantly. They won't be counting on massive pay rises year after year after year. They'll have a more cautious attitude towards debt than we do.
But today, things are different than they were in the past. The way debt has been leveraged has changed. The complexity of the financial instruments that are being used to fuel financial growth has changed a lot.
That's right, and that's why there's a lovely idea that goes back in ancient history called a jubilee, which the Jews invented, which was the idea of forgiving all your debts every 50 years. If only we could do that, then you'd think we'd solve the problem. The trouble is, it's such a complex system that we'd have to rescue all the creditors if we rescued the debtors. So it's unfortunately not as easy a solution as we might like.
Now, we talk about China and the Middle East as the major creditors right now, but the Chinese economy has slowed down. What happens if the creditor economy hits a slow patch?
Well, it's a worry because China has grown. I mean, it's not slowing down that much. It's grown 9 to 10% for such a long time, and it's very unusual for economies to grow for so long, so fast. So, yes, at some point in the future, China will have a big crisis.
Well, there's a real estate bubble.
In China. Yeah, there are plenty of people who think that, you know, they've lent money to lots of businesses which will never pay it back. I mean, the great thing though is that China, because they have $3.2 trillion of reserves, they can use some of that money to rescue their banking system, which is, of course, not. We don't have all those reserves in America or Britain behind us to help ourselves out.
And China has taken a rather dim view of the levels of borrowing in the United States and elsewhere. Are we also a major market for their good? But we're also a major market for their good, so they're caught in a bind as well.
Of course. It's a bit like mutually assured destruction. They depend on us and we depend on them. But it's a very similar relationship to Germany and Greece. You see the Germans lecturing the Greece on being spendthrift, the Greeks lecturing the Germans on, you know, being unreasonable. You've got that same customer supplier relationship between America and China.
Well, the picture you paint is rather disturbing. Do you think there's anybody out there who has any solutions?
Unfortunately, there's not an easy solution. I mean, the best solution would be some sudden spurt of economic growth, perhaps from some technological breakthrough, you know, new energy supply or something. Let's hope it comes through. And America is better placed than Europe in dealing with this crisis. That's the good news.
Philip Coggins' latest book is called Paper Promises, Debt, Money, and the New World Order. The book is published by Public Affairs. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much, Leonard.